Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. I am really happy today. Well, I'm happy most days, really, but especially to have one of my favorite guests, Joan Price, back. And she hasn't been on in a couple of years, but she's the perfect guest. She is, in my mind, an advocate, and in many people's minds, an advocate for ageless sexuality. She's the author of a number of books on aging and sexuality. The most recent one that we're going to be talking about today is Sex After Grief, Navigating Your Sexuality After Losing Your Beloved. Welcome back to the program, Joan Price.
Well, thank you for inviting me again, Diana. I love talking to you.
Thank you. It's very mutual. So this book is filled with good advice, and you lived it, and I did too. And in fact, in about 2011 or 12, we were talking about the loss of our husbands.
Yes.
And so here we are back again. Now you have a whole book about it, and I really like this quote on your page 125. I like teaching them that they are not replacing love, they are adding to love. And this is really hard for many widows and widowers, is it not?
It absolutely is, because so many people who have lost their partners, whose partners have died, let's be frank about it, who have within them, of course, the human life force to love, to be connected, to be sexual, and yet they feel, how can I? Wouldn't it be a betrayal of my lover? Or wouldn't I be comparing this person, and no one could compare? And I try to make the point, well, a lot of points in here, but one of them is, you're not comparing. You're opening yourself to a new person when it's time for you. And what you shared with your deceased lover is a part of you. You're not replacing your beloved. You're adding to your life. You're expanding. You're taking your ability to love, your ability to be intimate, that you learned with that lover, you're taking that with you.
So that was part of the reason, because you learned so much during this process after Robert died in 2008?
Yes.
So you learned a lot and you felt, well, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you learned personally, and then, of course, there's so much that you're sharing with others, but what did you learn personally? And kind of combined with the question, what led you to write this book? And maybe those questions are combined.
When I lost Robert, I went into such profound and all-encompassing grief that I was barely able to function, much less think about what my new normal, as they say in grief parlance, might be, or what new person might then enter my life to enrich it. I couldn't even imagine it. And I went through, over the years, because it took me years, I went through many things that other people go through. Maybe they go through one or two of them. I went through, I don't know, 8 or 12 of them, of trying different things, of failing. It wasn't really failure, but at the time I saw it as failure, of trying to date, trying to hide under the covers, trying to have sex with an old sexual partner, having to meet new people, trying to meet new people, and each time scurrying back under the covers and realizing that if I, a sex educator, was having so much trouble bringing sex and intimacy and connection back into my life, what must people who don't do this as a day job, how must they cope? So I realized, and it took me really this long, 11 years, before I was ready to write this book, which I wish I had had to read at the time.
Yes.
I was going through the worst of it.
Yes.
And I realized that all the things I experienced in my grief journey that it was important to be open about that, to share that, even if I was thinking at some points, my gosh, it takes me into a really dark place to write this, or it is, I may be embarrassed later that I admitted this, but I said, no. I have a purpose here. I have a mission, and that is to help other people who are going through what I went through and could use this information.
Yes, we write what we need to write, and mm-hmm. I can relate to, yes, to if you had had the book that you wrote, it might have accelerated your grief process, but what you do so brilliantly, Joan, is you normalize the whole process of grief, and you're whatever time it takes you, it takes you. But if
exactly.
you'd had some of the insights a little sooner, it might have made the process a little easier, or not necessarily. Maybe you just needed to do what you needed to do as you went on your journey.
It's interesting you put it that way. I think I would have needed to do it the way I did it, but I wouldn't have felt guilty or inadequate about it. If I'd had this book, if I'd had a book that normalized all the things I was feeling, all the things I was going through, and that also gave me options that let me see maybe a different kind of relationship would work for you right now. It doesn't mean you're a different person. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. you're abandoning what you believed in at the time. It just means that we are profoundly changed by grief. And how
yes.
I described it at one point, at the worst of it, my grief felt like I was bicycling through peanut butter while an elephant kicked me in the chest.
That's a very vivid metaphor, my goodness. Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, it just describes how profound it is, and how lost one can feel when you're in the midst of peanut butter and
yes.
trying to
I wouldn't
get
have been
through
ready
it.
For a book like this. I wouldn't have been ready to read it if it had been available at that point mm-hmm. in my grief journey. But at the point where I'm trying to find footholds in the peanut butter to climb out,
mm-hmm.
kept sliding back. But I know if I could just get to the edge and heave myself over, maybe I'd just find more peanut butter, but maybe I would find something different. It was at that stage that this book would have helped me.
One of the things that you did, which you have included in your book, is journaling. And I think it's such a good idea for people that are widowed to do this. And you had a personal journal and you had a grief journal. And you quote from your journals in your book. And then, of course, you say you must date. And I always say that to my clients, too. If you're journaling, you must date them so that you can look uh-huh. back and see your progress.
Right.
But talk about your journaling and how that helped you.
Being a writer, of course, I wanted to turn to writing to help me through this time. But I was stymied because part of me wanted to write memories of Robert, beautiful, beautiful memories of Robert. But the other part wanted to write just what I was going through, whether it was awful or a few little successes here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And how did I do both without, tainting the Robert memories with the horrible stuff? So I decided,
yes.
and I'd never heard this before, to keep two journals. That
mm-hmm.
one of them would only be the Robert memories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other would be my grief journey and anything else. Any calls, any anger, sorrow, attempts to date, funny things that happened, crying in the car, home from a date, whatever it was, no holds barred, and that I would handwrite it, even though I am used to writing on the computer. And by handwriting, it felt like it went from my heart through my hand, rather
mm-hmm.
than having to go via my brain to the typing fingers. I don't know if you know what I mean.
I do. That's fascinating. And I believe it's true. I haven't actually thought about that. Yeah. And you're so honest, and you, and then you were able to do that in your personal journey to really look at the downsides. And then you could, if you wanted to inspire or just sort of swim in happy memories, you could read your Robert journal.
Exactly.
Yes. And does he still sort of linger around in your memory? I'm sure he does. I know my Charlie does.
Only when I breathe in and out.
In and out, yeah.
Only when I breathe in and out. In other words, all the time, sure. And I have times where, of course, I'm doing things independently. It's 11 years after losing him. I've done a lot in my life in those 11 years.
Yes, you have.
He's always there. He's always there. And sometimes, like this this past weekend, I was at the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Summit, which is a wonderful sex conference. It's just wonderful. It brings sex activists of many different stripes together to talk about what they're doing and what they're needing and how we can change the world and change the laws, but also change how people see sexuality and people who are involved in different areas of sexuality. And always, and I was on the go, bustling. I did a reading from my book. I did all sorts of, gave a workshop. There was a screening of the film that I recently completed. Always at the end of the day, I'd settle down, and I'd see Robert nodding his head.
Uh-huh.
Fine today. He's always with me, and even if I'm not thinking about him, which I often am, but even if I'm not, what I learned from him and what I learned from our relationship, it's in me. It's in everything I do. This is him.
Yes, yes. I believe that. I can relate. You're, and that's why, to go back to the quote of yours from your book that I said at the top of the show, that you're not replacing him. You are just adding on, but you're taking with you all of those beautiful lessons you learned about loving someone so deeply in an emotional and physical way, that kind of intimacy, that deep kind of intimacy, emotional and physical, and you're taking that all with you. You became a better person for having known Robert.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, and
yes.
I feel the same about my late husband too. And it just but it's I felt it more because he died in 2000, so I have, oh, well, next year it'll be 20 years. I found in the first few years he was more with me than he is now, although maybe some of that is that I've remarried and I'm having such a happy, sexy marriage. But still, Charlie is always with me. I learned so many things, the reflection back, those mirror neurons in our brains, right?
Yeah.
So.
And he would want this happiness for you that you're having now.
Yes, he would. And we talked about that because his wife had died pretty early. And he said it was a mistake that she and I never talked about what we would do if the other one dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a mistake. It's a hard conversation to have. I bet you had that with Robert. You were his caregiver,
absolutely,
for one
did.
Thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. And I teach that to people, to have that conversation. And in fact,
yes.
I don't know if you, you probably know that I do a column for seniorplanet.org. It's a Q&A once a month. And the one this month, August, is,
mm-hmm.
the question is from a man whose wife has dementia and
mm-hmm.
And is physically healthy, but is deteriorating, recognizes him a little now. He guesses won't recognize him at all. Won't recognize him at all within a year. And he wants to, he says he's providing the best care he can for her. But what about him? How can he care for himself? And he desperately craves intimacy and touch and connection with someone else. So he wrote to me asking, how do you start dating in this kind of situation?
And how did you answer? I imagine very sensitively and also, yeah, how did you answer?
Well, I told him that given his circumstances, that he absolutely could, in my opinion, feel free to start dating, to start seeking that kind of connection that he can't get with his wife anymore. And he had asked me, well, how do I, women don't want to date someone who's still the wife. Mm-hmm. And he talked about using online dating and how, what is he's going to scare everybody off if he's honest, but he wants to be honest. And I told him, yes, be honest, of course. That the mm-hmm. women who want live-in lovers and husbands are going to skip right by him, and that's fine.
That's true, yes.
Because he doesn't want them. They aren't right for him.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the people who, I'm actually going to call up that article right now so I can tell you something that's in it. Because
it's
really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the computer. So.
I know what you're doing. Maybe while you're finding it. Oh, did you find it?
I've got it. Do you need to take a break? He said, I sometimes wonder what my wife and I would have said to each other if we knew this terrible illness was going to happen to her and therefore mm-hmm. to both of us. I hope my wife would have said this, quote, please take care of me until I pass naturally. I do not have good quality of life, so let me pass with no extraordinary measures. Please build mm-hmm. for yourself a life with a new partner. For better or worse, you will never forget me or our life together, although I have. Thank you for our life together, and I'm sorry this happened to us. Hopefully someday there will be a cure.
That is a beautiful letter.
I know.
And it captures so much emotional feeling and the character of. So that was the man writing to his wife.
It's what he wished his wife had written to him.
Right, and but she wasn't capable.
But she hadn't. She developed dementia without ever having that conversation. So one of the things I recommend. Is I say, those of you who are fortunate enough to have loving partners now, show them Lonely Husband's story, especially his ending paragraph, and discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
Give your
mm-hmm.
partner the gift of knowing that you want them to seek closeness, intimacy, and joy with others if you can no longer provide these. Difficult as it is, have this conversation now. Put it in writing.
It's very important, and it's a very generous thing to do.
Yes.
You know, to say, I wish you well. I want your happiness. I want you to move on. And you're so good at expressing love and receiving love, and you should be able to do this with somebody else. You have much to offer.
Yes.
Yes. Well,
when Robert and do you need to take a break? I just
no. We don't take it. Okay. We go straight through. We'll be stopping about
super
2 to 3 minutes before the top of the hour.
Okay,
go straight through.
When Robert knew he was dying, but he was still well enough to communicate and to interact with me to some extent, he was. Still, he was quite sick, and we were approaching our wedding anniversary, which was in
mm-hmm.
May. He died in August. And he said, what do you want as a wedding present, an anniversary mm-hmm. present? And
mm-hmm.
I said, a love letter.
No. Yes.
I treasure that letter more than anything. He gave me beautiful things, but he created beautiful art for me. Just what I treasure the most is that love letter.
Of course.
We don't realize how much we can give someone at no cost.
Love letters. Mm-hmm. Well, I got love letters while Charlie was alive, but he died in front of me at a spa of a heart attack. So I didn't have any time to, it was so sudden and so unexpected because he was only 57. But I had a different sort of journey than somebody who's a caregiver. It's shocking when your spouse dies so suddenly and unexpectedly. It's shocking, it's shattering. But then there are other kinds of problems and issues when you're a caregiver and you have to see your loved one dying slowly, and then the tolls that caregiving takes. I mean, there have been several studies on this, but I remember years ago on one of my radio shows when I was in Hawaii talking about caregivers, and they often have health problems, high blood pressure.
Mm.
They're not in very good health themselves. They're not taking care of themselves. They're so focused on the other. And
sure.
There's no good way for a loved one to die, whether it's suddenly or after a long illness. Maybe there's a little less suffering. That's what I used to think, that I was glad that Charlie didn't have to suffer.
Less suffering for the beloved, but not less suffering for us.
Yeah. No, that's right.
I'm sure.
That's right.
With the way Charlie died, you've relived that over and over and over and over again and thought, stop me if I'm wrong, that, you know, the last thing I said to him was, or the last time we laughed was, and just going back and trying to piece together, if you had known that this would be the last time, would it have been different?
Yeah, maybe so. I was really very fortunate because, like, I remember the last night we had together, it was filled with just lots of passionate, almost ethereal lovemaking.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. And I remember looking at him during that, and it was the next morning that he died, and thinking he looked so young and handsome. It was almost like he was ready to go to the other side.
Wow.
I mean, we had no idea. But so I personally feel that my spirituality developed as a result of Charlie's dying and thinking about all that he meant to me and we meant to each other and how I had perhaps I had I feel like I did deepen as a person, for one thing, the memento mori idea. Do you know about that idea?
I don't.
Well, it's about that, the notion that, yes, we'll all die, and I feel like the older I get, I'm certainly more aware of my mortality, and we'll all die, and so we want to make the most of the time we have to perhaps deepen our family relations, and to recognize that life is short, and we really want to spend time with those we love. And of course, we do things professionally. You do, I do, and work with people that really are struggling. And that's satisfying work because we can help. We can help them see that there is some light at the end of the struggle, perhaps.
Right.
If they do the work.
That's right.
They do the work. And your books are just such a testimonial to all of that. Can you just tell our listening audience, of course, they can get a real lot of detail if they go to joanprice.com, which I'll put up, of course, when I review when I summarize the show. But tell us about your writing and where it started, and the books that you've had and how one led to the next, and just kind of an overview of that before we get back to Sex After Grief, your most recent
book. Sure. One thing I want to say about Sex After Grief first, because I worry that I'll forget to say it, is that it isn't all me. As we've been talking, it sounds like the book is all me, but I had dozens of other grievers with all kinds of different experiences write to me the important things about their grief journey that, and their reclaiming their sexuality that they were willing to share. And that really enriches the book because it gives all kinds of experiences and it lets people know that there isn't one way that works for everyone and that for everybody there is some way that will work.
Oh, yes, your little boxes in the book, I'm just looking at one right now on page 63, A Griever Shares. Grief is a process that has its own timeline. Never, never say to someone in grief, when are you going to get over it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is likely I will never get over it.
Right.
It has become a part and parcel of who I am. Don't presume to know how I should engage with my grief. You can, however, be supportive, sympathetic, and empathetic.
Yes.
Very nice. There's so many griever shares that really are profound. And, you know, I'm imagining that you really helped these people because on your website and on your blogs, you encourage people, and in your books, you encourage people to write to you, say, how valuable was this book and in what ways, and may I share your remarks, or you want them just between you and me. And of course, you would never use their name, but you get a lot of messages, and I know you're helping people with that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And you asked about my other books.
Yes, please.
I started writing about sex and aging 14 years ago, and it's so hard to believe it's been that long that this has been my full-time day job. And I love it. I love it. Who could have a more exciting day job?
When you got to review sex toys. But that's another story.
Well,
we'll talk about that.
I review sex toys on my blog. I review sex toys from a senior perspective. And as I always said, it's a tough job, but someone's got to do it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So you went from your first book 14 years ago. I think I was in that book along with my good friend, late friend, Candida Royale. Wasn't that Naked at Our Age?
That was Naked at Our Age, but the first book was Better Than I Ever Expected.
Oh, yes.
Great talk about sex after 60. And that one, the whole idea of it was to celebrate older age sexuality because it was something that at that time no one was talking about and no one certainly was celebrating it. So that was the first one. The second one, which fortunately you were willing to write something marvelous for, was Naked at Our Age, talking out loud about senior sex. And that one won two awards, was nominated for a third, and I'm just so proud of that. That had 145 reader stories, 45 experts addressing their issues, and a running commentary by me throughout it. I still love that book so much. Then
I still look at it from time to time. It's in my bookshelf. Yes.
Mm.
It's a great book. Oh. Then what?
Mm-hmm. Sorry. then I edited an anthology of erotica called Ageless Erotica, written by mostly professional erotica writers age 50 and over, and featuring characters age 50 and over who were having hot, steamy sex, but the way we do have it now, not just young people's sex with wrinkles slapped on.
That's right. You have to make some adjustments sometimes. Like if your lover has arthritis or...
Exactly. In fact, that's one of the stories in there, is a woman wants to pleasure her husband with her hand, but she has wrist arthritis. So she starts getting an array of gloves that make her wrist feel better, and they're very sexy. She becomes a glove collector. Anyway, there are all sorts of things. Then I wrote,
I think that Ageless Erotica is a beautiful book and a sexy book, and it works very well. I've suggested it for some of my older couples that are bereaved, or and including divorced, because divorce is like a death of hopes and expectations. Yeah, just to be able to get, you have a whole chapter on solo sex and how important that is, and maybe you need the sex toys to, in fact, I think you do, to get you often, to get you jump-started, yes. Just feeling alive again. And so I think it's great. I often point out to my female clients that usually finding an erotic story that you like before you sit down and set the scene, and maybe with candles and music and taking a leisurely bath beforehand and or a shower, that you set the scene for yourself saying, I deserve pleasure, and to just enjoy that and read, because women are more likely to enjoy written erotica than visual erotica. Not always, I'm just saying more likely. So I think your book is very good for that, to keep the woman focused.
One of the things that I love about the stories in Ageless Erotica is that they are so varied. There
yes.
There are sex with longtime loved ones that are very tender. There's sex with strangers. There's sex with multiple people. There's sex mm-hmm. with toys. There's sex with self. And there's BDSM. There are all sorts of different things. And in fact, I have sort of a funny anecdote about this. I gave a copy to my uncle, who was maybe 88 years old at the time. And he said, oh, that it's just wonderful. And I said, what's your favorite story? And he stopped for a moment. He said, I don't think I want to tell you because you know too much about me.
He sounds like a character.
Yes.
Was one of his ones kind of kinky? One of his favorites?
I don't know which one. I suspect so.
Yeah. But he didn't tell you.
He didn't tell me. So that just let me imagine.
Mm-hmm. But how happy he was that he read the book.
Yes,
he did. And it got his juices flowing.
It did.
Yes.
I was going to say
your solo sex chapter is very good, and I think it's and I just love the quotes. Let me see if I can get to those that you have on page 42, and I'm just going to read a couple of them, and then
okay.
let's
so just to
talk more about toys
after grief, not Ageless Erotica right now.
Yeah, we're talking about sex after grief. Thank you very much. So, some quotes to inspire you. You have, and I love Lily Tomlin's. We have reason to believe that man first walked upright to free his hands for masturbation. I love that. And Joyce Elders, I got to meet her, former U.S. at one of our conferences, former U.S. Surgeon General, and
Joyce.
Yes, Joyce Lynn, Elders, yes. We know that more than 70 to 80% of women masturbate, and 90% of men masturbate, and the rest lie, she said.
Yeah.
And finally, Dan Savage, you know, who lives here in Seattle and is, I think, editor of The Stranger and has his column, which I'm sure you know. In fact, you've been in it. You've been quoted in it.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, Savage Love.
He wrote the blurb for Sex After Grief. He wrote the blurb for my book.
I know he did. And then there's this quote of his in your book, inside the book. If God didn't want us to masturbate, we wouldn't have been given these long arms. So that certainly is true. Yeah, the blurb he gave you is so good. Well, I really like it, and I have to find it now. But maybe you know it. It's about
cover.
He would read. Oh, I yes, here it is. Joan Price is one of the smartest thinkers around about sex. Smartest thinkers around about sex, regardless of your age or hers. He's so right on, isn't he? And his column goes, it's syndicated nationally, and I think even in some places internationally.
And his podcast is marvelous. He has a free version of it and a paid version of it that is twice as long.
Okay, I need to follow up on that. I should.
Yes.
My goodness.
It's
Savage Love.
Savage Love Cast.
Savage Love Cast. Okay.
And I really recommend subscribing because the free version is 45 minutes, and the paid version, and it's not very much. It's something like $39 a year, and he has
that's
a podcast
not bad at
weekly,
all.
Right? 52 podcasts for that, and it's an hour and a half with no ads.
Ah, okay. And does it show up in your smartphone or your computer if you get
right.
that?
Right. Yeah. However you subscribe to podcasts, it'll show up, whether it's iTunes or whatever way you do it. I have it just show up in my podcast app. It just shows up every Tuesday.
Oh, good. All right. Well, we're giving Dan Savage a pretty good promo here. Well deserved. And so talk just a little bit about the sex toys that you have. You don't talk about it a lot in your book, but in other places, your blog. So sex
My
toys
blog
that are
and also the book we didn't mention, The Ultimate Guide to Sex After 50. There's a ton about sex toys in there.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about them all the time.
I know.
Often the workshops I give are in sex toy shops. And also, I have a webinar that's called Sex Toys for Seniors. And in it, it was so much fun to prepare this webinar. It's an hour and a half. And I show a couple of dozen of my favorite sex toys and talk about what I like about them. First, I talk about why sex toys altogether and try to dispel the myths. There are some myths around sex toys that are really destructive to us, such as we shouldn't need sex toys. We should be able to have orgasms naturally. I have air quotes in naturally. We should be able to dance without knee braces, too. But at a certain point, a knee brace not only enhances our dancing, but makes it possible. And likewise...
Nice analogy. I like that, Joan.
Thank you.
I just want to add on what I learned when I was at UCLA's Female Sexual Medicine Center. And there were women, even younger women in their 30s and 40s, who were so stressed out, and their levels of testosterone were low. We know that a lot of stress lowers testosterone. And then we discovered the medical doctors presumed that if a woman does not masturbate as a teenager through about 25, the theory is she doesn't develop the neural pathways that go from the genitals to the brain. And so she may need extra help to reach orgasm, that extra stimulation that goes deeper and 300 times faster than a finger or a tongue or a penis can go. So it really can help. And what's exciting is that there's no upper age limit for a woman to even have her first orgasm, but it almost requires a vibrator.
Yes, absolutely.
So what were some of your favorites?
Some of my favorites. Okay. Oh, boy. Well, how much time have you got? That webinar is an hour and a half. But
it's just sort of a summary of it.
Okay. Well, I like strong sensation, And, of course, the magic wand is a wonderful tool. And, by the way, I call them, although they're called sex toys, and I call them that just so people know what I'm talking about, I really think of them as orgasm tools. They're tools. They're not toys.
They're tools. That's right.
And for traveling, I like the WeVibe Touch very much. And
I
the
do
Palm
too.
Power. For penises, the Hot Octopus Pulse is marvelous. The Pulse, the Pocket Pulse. There's a new one. I'm forgetting the name right now. I've got them all on my blog, though, because I review them, or my penis owner of choice reviews them. Everything from Fun Factory, Fun Factory is the company, is marvelous.
And they're out of Germany, as I recall.
They're out of Germany, but they're available in all the good American sex toy retailers.
Well, I know, but they're very well made.
And they have
very quiet motors in them. And can go at different speeds as the WeVibe ones, yeah.
And they're very strong. They're made of great materials. My favorite from Fun Factory is the Volta, V-O-L-T-A, which is... you got to look at the... Go to joanprice.com. At the top, there's a tab that says blog. I've got a newly designed website, so you don't have to go all over the Internet to find the different things I'm doing.
Good.
All in one place now. And you can see some of those. I love the Erosolator, which I've been using for decades. And both the Erosolator and the Magic Wand are so well made. They never break. They never they never even get tired.
I know. That's what I say. I say to any of the couples that I might be seeing, and the man is a little hesitant about introducing a sex toy, that even one that can be used on his partner's clitoris while they're having intercourse. You know, if some man is resistant to that, I'll say, you know, think of this vibrator or this dildo or whatever as your friend. It never gets tired.
and always
stays hard. But some men can't quite get that right away, but then often they do when they see with the pleasure that their partner can have. And I often recommend that the woman might show first that she try the sex toy on herself when she's alone, and then give her partner a demonstration.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And one thing I'd like to say is, even though a lot of these products are designated either for vulvas or for penises, it's all stimulation. You could touch any erogenous zone of any gender with any of these toys, with very few exceptions. I mean, there's some that are made so that a penis goes into them, and that's pretty hard to do with a vulva. But overall, most sex toys can be used on any gender, any erogenous zone. And it's just a matter of, that's where the play comes in, is seeing what feels good.
Yeah, to see what feels good. Can we jump to your chapter 13, which is massage or more? And, of course, a massage is a very good way, when someone has been bereaved, to maybe get back into feeling sensual again. And you booked yourself an erotic massage, which I thought was brilliant. So do you mind sharing? Well, you share it in the book, so I imagine you don't mind sharing it.
No, of course not.
Yeah. So what about your erotic massage?
Well, I wish, first of all, getting a little soapbox here, I wish erotic massages were legal and easily available for any gender that wants it, from any gender that wants to give it. Yeah, unfortunately, in the United States, that's not true. But it's still can find them. And what is, I mean, some of your listeners may go, what do you mean? What happens? What doesn't happen? Well, erotic massage is a massage, a regular therapeutic massage, except that the genitals are not off limits.
And you can have the happy ending. Ta-da!
Yeah, that's right. And it's not that they are selling the orgasm, But if the orgasm happens, that's fine. And it will. So my erotic massage at age 66, I think. I gave it to myself as on my 66th birthday.
Yes.
And I had been celibate for a year and a half already and was not ready to engage with partnered sex, but I did want to receive sexual pleasure from another person. I mean, my sex toys were great, but they were predictable in that I knew where my hand was going to put them at any given moment. And there's something really sexy about being surprised by where a hand goes at any moment. So I booked, after some very careful research and some recommendations from people I trust, I booked an erotic massage, and it was glorious. Glorious. Here was someone whose goal for 2 hours was to pleasure me.
Yes, for 2 hours. Oh, you got a very good one.
It was a real massage also. It wasn't go straight to the genitals. It was
right, of course.
It was the full massage that you would ordinarily get, and then honing in on the genitals for as long as I wanted. And it was always consent oriented too. May I touch you here? Do you want me to do this? It was never. There were never any assumptions. I never had a second of worry of what was going to happen. It was all spelled out ahead of time. Part of that 2 hours, actually, was talking first, telling my massage therapist what was going on in my life that led me to book him, and him explaining his rules, that this was to be all honoring me, and it was not, no reciprocation was either required or permitted.
Right.
So that's really good to know. And he said that at any point that I didn't feel comfortable, then nothing would happen. Only he would ask for consent at any point that he was going to then maybe change things up. And it was really beautiful.
Well, and it gave you really had some confirmation then that you still were a very sensual, sexual woman, and that you could be responsive and feel so alive and attractive.
Because I didn't even know that. I didn't know if I would respond.
I thought,
well, I'll get a good massage, but this is an expensive way to find out that I can't respond. But no, it was an expensive way to find out I can.
And it was a very important step along the way. You also talk in your book, see, lots of people just love you, Joan, because you're so open and you can be outrageous in some people's minds. Oh, we never could consider that. But so you ask on page 123, is a sex surrogate for you? And you explain what a sex surrogate is, a trained professional who works therapeutically. Well, in a way, kind of like your massage therapist. But some surrogates will actually go on to intercourse if that's what you want to do.
Yes,
is that true?
A surrogate is not the same as my massage therapist at all.
No, I understand.
A sex surrogate is really trained to work therapeutically both on the physical, sensual level, but also on the emotional level, and often is referred by sex therapists.
Yes, I've worked collaboratively with surrogates. Not often,
but yes,
especially since I moved away from California.
And
well, because sex surrogacy is in kind of a gray area here, so it's a little more underground, and it's too bad. In California, that's not true.
And that is too bad. And I don't know why we have to be so restrictive and prudish about sex when this is something that is human. It is part of the human being of us that we are sexual, and it is part of, I've got to say, our repressive culture that we need help with that sometimes. If we were if we felt we had freedom to explore our sense, our pleasure in any way we want to express it, consensually with another human being or alone, whatever gender, whatever form it takes, wouldn't the world be better? Well, you wouldn't have as much work, probably.
No, that's right. Absolutely. One reason I don't plan to retire is that there's so much satisfaction in helping people recover their sexual feelings or get them for the first time or work. Anyway, it's just very, very satisfying. You have a griever shares on page 123 in your book. So here's a widower, he was just so deeply in grief, and he was so longing for some touch, and he contacted a sexual surrogate, and he writes, "This turned out to be one of the best decisions of my life. At our first meeting, I poured out personal sexual information like a spy on truth serum." Sometimes we need a special someone with whom we can feel safe. Oh, the safety part is huge. Who has no agenda except to help us. Intimate time with a surrogate goes hand in hand with talk. Skin on skin contact is therapeutic. Being naked and breast to breast, holding each other as tight as you can, frees up so much emotion. This intimate time is nothing like casual sex. That guy, he gave you a lot in that paragraph
I'm
or
so
two.
So grateful
about
for
how
him.
Yes.
Yeah, he came forward. The way I got my griever to come forward, I have a newsletter that I send out roughly monthly, and anyone who's interested in that, just subscribe from my website. You'll see there's a button to hit and subscribe very easily. And I asked in a newsletter, I said, I'm writing this book, and I explained what it was going to be, and said, and asked, if you have been in grief because of the death of your beloved, and you have experiences to share, would you please email me? And then I'll ask you for permission if I would like to use it. And I got so many. And his was, most of them I only took little excerpts from, but his was so important that he was willing to share this experience. That's really important for us to know that's possible and to know what a sex surrogate really does and not to think, oh, yeah, well, that's just, no, it's not just anything. It is really therapeutic and really important. And what he got, he said, in fact, that that this was so instrumental to his healing that he wanted to share that. And it turns out I actually know the sex surrogate that he worked with, who is marvelous, who's just a marvelous person and really an empath, I think. It's a job, but it's a job with more than empathy. It's a job with a real connection that for that time that they're together, or whatever partner she has, it doesn't have to be male, is the total focus of what she has to give, and it's beautiful.
Well, I know and I've talked about Cheryl Cohen, who's a sex surrogate out of Berkeley, and then they made a movie based on one of her clients who had polio. You probably know it,
right.
The Session. And this goes back, it came out maybe in 2009, actually.
I saw it a long time ago. I don't remember. Yeah.
Yeah. And coincidentally, right about the time the movie came out, I was seeing somebody who was in a wheelchair. And I told him to see the movie, and he did, and he wept through much of it. So for people with disabilities, this can be life-changing, even more life-changing than for somebody who's grieving, although it's all very powerful. But we have to have an open mind, and you have one, and I have one, and a lot of people have a little trouble even thinking about something like that, and we shouldn't, and you do that in your book. You honor these people You say mm-hmm. it takes whatever time it takes for you.
That's
is
right.
Okay. You normalize yeah. it.
Yes. Yes. The last thing we need at this time is people telling us what we should be doing or when we should be mm-hmm. ready or ready too fast. That's why I have a chapter on the myths about sex and aging. I mean, the myths
yeah.
about sex and grief. I'm sorry. In yeah. fact, this book is not just for people who are older. It is for all ages. Most of the grievers who wrote to me are older, but that isn't necessary for any of the points that I make.
That is all very true, and I think I looked at the myths in your book, and they're, well, we're about to wind up, so, but they're important myths. Wait at least a year before having sex with a new partner. Sex with someone new is disloyal to your deceased loved one. All of these myths that really impact a lot of people who are grieving. You should wait until you're no longer grieving. And mm-hmm. I like what you say here. Grief can coexist with desire, even love, for a new person.
That's right.
It's not either or.
Right.
Well,
we are complex enough to be capable of multiple emotions at the same time.
Multiple emotions. So, Joan, they're going to give us the music pretty soon, which means the program is ending. But you have a very powerful chapter at the end, What's Next? And I like at the end of each chapter you say your takeaway. What parts of this book were most valuable to you? And then you must have gotten feedback about that.
I have not yet because the book just came out.
Oh, that's true. I didn't think about that.
But I expect to, and I welcome it, and I hope I do hear from people. I have heard from a few people who read it right away as soon as they got it, but I look forward to hearing from others who pick it up, and I am traveling around and giving talks. So if people go to joanprice.com, if you look under the speaking tab to events, you'll see if I might be coming to a city near you, and that would be lovely to meet people in person. But otherwise, joanprice.com will connect you at least to everything I'm doing.
Thank you, Joan. Once again, you're just the most amazing guest and so knowledgeable and so open. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diana.
You're welcome, Joan. Bye, everybody.
Happy feet. Da-da-da, happy feet. Da-da-da, happy feet. Oh, I love it.